This is the Blacklist Podcast. I'm one of your two hosts, Franklin Leonard, founder and CEO of the Blacklist, joined as always by
Kate Hagen, director of community at the Blacklist.
So today we have a conversation with one of my favorite people. And beyond that, for my money, one of the most underappreciated currently working directors in the game. If you haven't seen her three films, Diary of a Teenage Girl, Can You Ever Forgive Me, and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, get on that because they're just extraordinarily good. And I'm excited for literally everything she does from here on out, including this conversation.
It's a wonderful chat with Mariel Heller. The reality is, if Mariel Heller had come out of the gate with those three films and was a male filmmaker, we would be talking about her as if she's the next Scorsese. But that is not the way
All facts.
That is not the way the industry conversation has gone. So we're going to dig in with Mari about the realities of gender and being a female filmmaker in this business. We're going to talk, of course, about directing the great Tom Hanks in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. But we're also going to take it back to her beginnings as an actor and talk about how that process has informed her work as a director. It's a really wide-ranging conversation with Mari and one that we think you're going to greatly enjoy.
We talk a lot about the theater in New York and the transition from that to becoming a great filmmaker. More of us talking, but this time with Mariel Heller. Enjoy.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm going to get right into it, and I'm going to begin with our first question, which is, can you remember the first movie you saw in a movie theater?
I think the first movie I saw in a movie theater was The Jungle Book, and I left because I was so scared.
What were you scared of? Do you remember the snake, specifically?
The snake, I think.
Fair. Yeah.
To this day, I'm kind of squeamish about movies. I'm not really that into scary movies. I can't really watch certain things. I think images really affect me. I remember Seven still giving me nightmares in probably high school whenever that movie came out.
Yeah, that sounds about right time-wise.
Yeah.
About the same age.
Yeah.
Seven is scary. You're allowed to have nightmares after Seven.
Yeah. And I wasn't a child then. I was older, but I remember all of my friends loving that movie, and I saw it in the movie theater. And it really, really messed me up.
Well, it's intended to be a terrifying movie.
It's like they
did the job. I mean, the Nightmare on Elm Street is still the one that really
never seen
me
it.
Up.
No,
it's just a genius construction because the whole idea is if you fall asleep, you're screwed.
Right.
And then if you see it, especially as a kid, you're lying in bed being like, "Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it." And then, of course, the second you fall asleep, your first dream is about it, and then the cycle continues.
Seven was the first movie I remember closing my eyes and seeing images from it, and like shooting my eyes open and feeling like, "No! Don't close your eyes." That terrible feeling.
So we've talked about a lot of people, like their movies that made them fall in love with movies. Is that the movie that made you realize the power of movies and then made you fall in love with movies, right? Was it like this weird sort of negative positive effect?
I think in some ways, realizing the power of movies. I also remember the Bjork movie where she's going blind.
Dancer in the Dark.
I also remember Dancer in the Dark really kind of messing me up in a similar way where the first time I watched it, I thought I hated it. The reason I felt like I hated it was because it made me so angry and I felt so much when I watched it.
Yep.
But on reflection, I realized, oh no, that's because it was so effective and so powerful. But I think I definitely have some weird relationship with art that feels like it's trying to torture you a little bit.
Really?
I don't know.
Are there other examples of this?
There's definitely theater I can think of. There was kind of a movement in downtown off-Broadway theater that was happening in like 2005 to 2010, where it was sort of like some of it was really effective and amazing. Like I'm thinking of the play Blasted and a lot of Adam Rapp's early work, where it was it was kind of meant to torture the audience. It was kind of trying to make you, people were really proud if like audience members threw up. You know what I mean?
Wait, was that a regular thing? See, I was already in LA by this point and missed the entire New York make
sort
your audience
of.
Vomit scene.
Yeah,
apparently.
Yeah. It was a thing for a couple of years. It was like, it was trying, you know, there was a lot of incest on stage. There was a lot of rape. There was a lot of strobe lights and things to give you seizures. I don't know. And something about all of that affected the kind of, at least the kind of movies I want to make in terms of, I never really want the audience to feel like they're being tortured by me.
So you are anti-audience vomiting.
Yeah, I am.
Rule.
I am. It's a bold statement.
It's a bold position.
Yeah.
Mari. I don't know what that's going to mean for your career.
But, I'm going to get a lot of controversial tweets my way because of that.
By the way, you never know. It's Twitter.
That's why I don't ever check it.
It's funny you mentioned Dancer in the Dark. Yeah, it's because like that's a movie I still will not watch because I know it's going to fuck me up. Like I'll watch all the Nightmare on Elm Streets, but like Dancer in the Dark, I'm like, ooh, I'm still not ready for that. I am not prepared.
Let's have a quick conversation about Dancer in the Dark because I watched it on what I thought was a date. And then I was hanging out with this very cool woman. I was like, I'm going to think of a really smart movie to watch because that's what I do. We watched Dancer in the Dark and it was
literally
like.
Wait, had you seen it already?
No, I had not. Oh, it was my first time viewing the movie and literally it ends. We both sort of look at each other and I was like, so I'm going to call you a cab. you know, check in on me in a week and make sure I haven't killed myself because that was. Brutal.
It's brutal.
And she and I are still friends, but it definitely completely ended any possibility of anything other than a friendship in that relationship.
So you're calling Dancer in the Dark a boner killer?
Yeah, for 100%. I think that is a safe characterization, though maybe not my first, maybe not the first adjective I would choose.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, look, what year did that movie come out? It was so many years ago and we're all still talking about it.
It had to have been like 01, 02 because it was when I was still living in New York.
Yep. Yeah. Remember the swan dress, guys? Truly simpler times.
It's
the
true.
Swan Oscars dress.
I would happily go back to days as innocent as those.
Me too.
But was there a movie that made you fall in love with movies? I'm guessing it wasn't Seven, even if it made you realize the power of images. Was there the movie that made, like, this is the thing that I have to do?
The movie that was my dad's favorite movie, and therefore, as a kid, I felt like was the first movie that I really kind of understood that movies could be powerful in that way, was Harold and Maude.
Oh, love it.
And I'm from the Bay Area, so it was also, the setting of it just felt really connected to me. It was so moving. I think it's when I learned about Cat Stevens. Just everything about that movie. I mean, I could watch that movie over and over again. I don't feel tortured by that movie at all.
And what's the strangest way you've ever watched a movie?
The strangest way?
Yeah, like, you know, on a tour bus, Kate's go-to answer is basically getting your hair done, right? Kate, am I crazy?
Dry bar is one. I've done some like outdoor screenings.
What do you mean? You mean you were at Dry Bar on your phone?
No, they had a movie on in the background of Dry Bar on mute. So you're like
even
watching Clueless on mute. Yeah,
it's
a very surreal experience. But yeah, Franklin talks about seeing like Water for Chocolate at a bar, just like weird locations, weird contexts.
In the back room. Of a bar in Durban, South Africa.
I'm trying to think. Nothing specifically springs to mind. I mean, I think that, you know, I constantly think as a filmmaker about how the filmmaker would want me to watch a movie and really try to not watch movies in a terrible way,
right.
Like on
Fair
my
enough.
Phone or, you know.
Fair enough. Fair
in
enough.
Any way that would make the filmmaker want to kill themselves because I just.
So prior to your becoming a filmmaker, what terrible way did you reject the filmmaker's desires that it be screened in 2.35:1? You can come back.
We'll
to
have
that
to come back to that. I've got no clever
it's a fun
answer.
Question. I keep waiting for somebody to be like, "Well, when I went to the space station, maybe we should just save this for people that are astronauts."
Yeah, that's
All
a
right,
good idea.
Let's dial back a little bit because I want to. Prior to becoming a filmmaker, can you walk us through your career? Because I'm always fascinated by how people end up in their first movie, especially when their first movie ends up being as remarkable as Diaries of a Teenage Girl.
Thank you. I was an actor. I started as an actor. I went to theater school. Theater was definitely my first love. So I graduated from UCLA Theater School in 01. And I basically was making my living doing regional theater. Then we moved to New York and I was doing a lot of new plays and theater development. And I guess for a while, I felt like I probably was going to write because I loved working on new plays. I loved working with playwrights. I loved watching the process of watching plays get written and rewritten and hearing actors speak the words. I loved being one of those actors who was the first one saying words that had been written. And then we were figuring out together kind of how they could be better. And that's such a big part of like the downtown theater scene in New York is new play development. And you'll be part of a play maybe for a year where you do workshops of it and then you redo it and you redo it and you watch it grow. So I just was fascinated by the writing process, even though I had never done it. And then when I read the book, The Diary of a Teenage Girl, which my sister had given to me as a gift, I don't know, it was like a light bulb went off for me. I was like, this is it. This is the thing I have to write. I have to adapt this book. I was so moved. I was so moved by the book. I had never felt like I read anything that was so relatable to me. I just felt so seen by the book. But I had no clue. I mean, I had no clue how to get the rights to a book or how to do anything. I literally Googled the publisher on the back and picked up the phone and just cold called the publisher.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think we've never talked about this. This is amazing.
No. And I obviously got a lot of rejection. I mean, everybody was like, no, what do you mean? No, you can't adapt this book. Tons of people had tried to adapt the book.
At what stage? So literally, you're just like, hey, this is the first thing I'm going to do. How can I get the rights to this?
Yeah. And I was going to write it as a play. My first vision was writing it as a play because that was really where I was coming from. So I called the publisher. They didn't laugh in my face. They were nice enough to connect me to Phoebe's agent, Phoebe the writer, Phoebe Gleckner. She said no. She said, people have been trying to get the rights to this book for years. It's really close to Phoebe's real life and to her real story. We guard it very closely. Thank you for your interest. No, thank you. And I just kept hounding her. I mean, it was kind of weird. Like at one point I sent her cookies to her office. Like I just was like, there's no reason why I should stop. She already said no. So why don't I just keep going? And I just kept calling, leaving messages, writing her emails. She put me in touch with Phoebe at one point. Oh, finally, she let me have a meeting with her and we had a really nice lunch and she connected me with Phoebe. But they were still basically saying no.
Right.
And so I just started sending Phoebe all these pictures of my cats because I could tell she liked her cats. And I felt like, okay, this is going to be my way in. I spent 8 or 10 months trying to convince them to let me get the rights to write it as a play. And at some point, I think they just realized like, well, what's the harm? It's just a play. Nobody sees theater anyway.
Right. It's going to be 5 people in a room downtown, whatever. Yeah.
So they said yes, just to the theatrical rights. And I started writing it as a play. And I spent many years writing it as a play. And it was the thing that made me fall in love with writing. And I raised the money. I brought on theater companies and raised the money. I mean, I killed myself trying to get this play off the ground. And we performed it. And I played Minnie. I played the teenage girl. And we performed it at this downtown theater down by World Trade Center called 3LD. And it was amazing. It was like, it was the best creative experience of my life. And it had taken by that time, probably 5 years all told between getting the rights, writing the play, writing multiple drafts, raising all the money and doing the production. And then it was sort of over. It was like, okay, that was that. That was the most passion I've ever had for a project in my life.
Right.
Now I love writing, but what am I going to do now? And I had started writing other projects. I had started working with a writing partner and we had written 2 screenplays at that point, which had gotten us an agent, but we hadn't gotten anything made. And so I started writing Diary as a film. I just felt like I wasn't done.
Did you have the film rights at this point?
No.
Like, what was the status of your relationship with
Okay. Phoebe and her agent came to see the play and loved it. And Phoebe and I, at that point, over the course of those many years when I had been working on it, we had actually become really close. And I had gone and stayed at her house in Ann Arbor. I'd become friends with her kids. Like, we really became like family over the course of working on this project. I mean, she was trusting me with this story that was so close to her. It was a really big privilege. So by the time I went to them to ask for the film rights, I kind of knew by then they would say yes. Because I think they felt like I had, the play was like a good trial. They felt like I had treated her story with respect.
And then you wrote the script and everybody gave you money and that was it, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I wrote the script and I gave it to a few people that I knew, one of them being Ann Carey, who was a producer I had had a few meetings with. And she was like, nobody's going to make this movie.
Yeah.
And she said, your best bet would be you should apply to the Sundance Labs, because at least if you went through the Sundance Labs, it would kind of give you some credibility. Maybe people would take you more seriously. So on her recommendation, I applied to the Sundance Labs and was just lucky enough to get in. And from then, I don't want to say things got easier. They got like incrementally easier. And I got a number of grants through Sundance that allowed me to kind of keep the ball rolling as I went along. But all told, by the time I was shooting the movie, I think I'd been working on the project for 8 years, 8 or 9 years. And at some point I calculated I had written 85 drafts between the play and the screenplay. I thought I was just going to rewrite forever and never make it as a movie.
It's so important to tell those stories, though, because I feel like we have all these sort of, you know, myths of like the overnight success, the overnight sensation.
It's my biggest pet peeve in a movie or a TV show when someone sits down to write and like writes some brilliant script in a night. Like, you're doing a disservice to the world.
Yeah, it's just not accurate. And I feel like it sets up people for disappointment and false expectations, because it's just like for 99.9% of us, that is not the way it's going to happen.
No, writing is torture. Writing is rewriting. Writing makes you lose your mind. You always feel like you're terrible at it. I know. I wish that's part of why I loved making the movie Can You Ever Forgive Me? Because I got to really show a writer actually struggling with how horrible it is to be a writer.
I want to talk a bit about Diary of a Teenage Girl more. Speaking of Sundance, that was where I got to see the movie. And it was one of those things I kind of picked out of the catalog and then came out of it being like, well, that's the best movie I'm going to see this year. Aww. It's such a striking debut film, both visually and narratively. But, you know, you were kind of hinting at some of the challenges you faced making a story that is so emotionally and sexually provocative. How did you sort of deal with those challenges through the process as people were trying to shift not only your vision, but Phoebe's vision? And did that at all sort of play into the process getting your second film made?
Well, in certain ways, I think the fact that it took me so long to make that movie and I worked on it for so many years before another person became involved actually really helped me be really clear with what I knew the project was and what it wasn't. So when I would get notes from people that just didn't match with my vision of what the project was, it was so clear. You know, if somebody gave me a note saying like, what if at the end she ends up with that nice boy from school? I'd be like, no, that's not the purpose of this movie. But I could be really clear, even though it was my first film, with everything that the project was and wasn't, because I was being sort of guided by this source material that I felt so much allegiance to. And I had been working on it for so many years. And like I said, I wrote so many drafts of it. I felt like I knew it so inside and out. But, you know, over the course of making it, people were really afraid of it. They were afraid of the amount of sex that was in it. They were afraid of the lack of a moral lesson. People were constantly grasping at what the movie was trying to tell people about teenage girls and their sexuality, and had a very hard time with the fact that I didn't want to moralize, that the point was to give voice to a teenage girl purely from her perspective without pulling back and giving a moral perspective. I had so many organizations, particularly organizations that are supposed to support women filmmakers, freak out about the project and not want to support it because they were afraid it wasn't feminist enough, even though I viewed it as a very feminist work and viewed Phoebe's book as one of the most feminist pieces of work I'd ever read because it also allowed this young woman to be so fully human. I mean, it was a real struggle. It was a real struggle to find partners who were brave and who were excited to work on the project and to not try to change it into something else. But I got so lucky with the people who I did work with. Caviar, who represented me and my husband on for commercials and wanted to make their first American movie, came in. And then Miranda Bailey came in as well with her company. And between the two of them, they understood what the project was. And between Ann Carey, who at that point was one of my producers, all of these producers didn't try to change what this was actually going to be. And then we got grants from CineReach. I mean, we had so many supporters over the course of the many years making it. But we weeded out a lot of people who wanted it to be something different over those years.
I'm just amused by the idea of you and Emily as somehow anti-feminist.
I know. I know. But I really felt like that's what people were saying to me. They were kind of going, okay, so what's the feminist message here? What are we saying about teenage girls and their sexuality?
There's so much thorniness, I feel like, with sex positivity in the sort of feminist movement. And if you don't sort of like, you know, like you were saying, the moral lesson, if you don't have a female protagonist who is like learning some massive truth about herself through the bad sex she's had, then it's not feminist, which is insane because you watch the film and it's incredibly in Minnie's point of view and it's incredibly true to her story.
And I think it's incredibly empowering to watch a girl explore her sexuality and have agency within her life and recognize her own relationship with men as shifting and changing. And, you know, I think seeing flawed women on screen is really powerful and feminist in itself too. And I don't know if that movie would be made today. That's the truth. Like, I think about it through the lens of 2020 or 2019 and where we are right now within our feminist movement and within the Me Too movement. I think the moral ambiguity would scare people even more in this moment.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I feel like there's been a tendency in art in the last couple of years, if it cannot be wrapped up in a sort of neat little bow at the end, to dismiss it or be scared of it rather than engaging with those complex feelings, which is kind of a great segue into talking a bit about your second film, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, which is such a great filmic middle finger to the sort of discourse surrounding this idea of the likable female protagonist, which is one of the most exhausting conversations any woman in film can have a given day. But it's my favorite Melissa McCarthy performance to date, and it's such a fascinating true story. Similarly with Lee, where you push to make her more sort of likable or sort of traditionally Hollywood in terms of how she's portrayed. And how did you fight those battles, especially because you're, you know, again, pulling from a true story that you can kind of go back to and be like, actually, this was her.
Wait, can I go back? Can I go back just a little bit? How did Can You Ever Forgive Me come to you? Because it's an unusual movie, and I'm curious like how you thought about saying, yeah, let me make the movie about this writer.
Well, it's a huge question about what you're going to make for your second movie, especially when you have a movie that was your first movie, like Diary, where I spent all told 10 years working on it. Right. Clearly, it was like my blood, sweat, and tears went into that film. And I think like a second album or whatever, there's so much pressure about, well, could you follow that up? You made a movie
And you're a woman.
Yeah. And I had a statistic in my head that I am not positive is totally true, but somebody told me along the way that the average female filmmaker takes 8 years to make her second film, whereas the average male filmmaker takes 3.
Yeah, I would love to say that that's not true, but it is.
Yeah.
I can't remember the source of it either, but it's that bad.
So I had that in my head as like, well, I can't become that statistic. I don't want to be that statistic. I'm gonna, even though I had just had a baby and I premiered Diary at Sundance with a 5-week-old. So in many ways, the thought of even trying to think about making another movie was like, what am I doing? My whole life has been flipped on its head and now I'm a mom. But I was like, I'm going to make another movie and I'm going to try to make another movie fairly quickly because I don't want to be one of those statistics. So Anne Carey, who had been the person who suggested I apply to Sundance, had ended up becoming a producer on Diary, was the one who had really... She was the engine behind Can You Ever Forgive Me for the many years and the many incarnations that existed before me. And there were many. There were 3 or 4 different versions of that film that almost happened and never happened. But she had known Lee and she had commissioned the script to be written from her book, from her memoir. And she had been working on that project for 10 years. So in the same way that Diary had sort of been my passion project going in the background of my life for so many years, this project had been her passion project that had been going for so many years. And it at this point was just sitting on a shelf collecting dust, sort of nothing at all was happening with it. Nothing had been happening with it for a year or two. And she brought it to me. And, you know, we had had a good working relationship on Diary and had now known each other for a number of years. So she brought it to me. And Searchlight had already been involved. So we went to Searchlight together and I just kind of talked through what I liked about it. And part of what I liked about it was, like you said, I felt like it was such a different version of femininity on screen than I was used to seeing. And with Diary, I had felt so proud of the way that we were able to show women on screen. And I felt like we need an even wider range of women that we're seeing on screen. And this like 51-year-old, basically agoraphobic lesbian alcoholic who is a writer who, if you passed her on the street, walking down the street in New York, you would just not think that she was the most interesting person to talk to. You would just pass her without a second thought. And yet she's fascinating. I thought she's so interesting. So I worked with Searchlight and worked on the script, and we brought it to Melissa McCarthy, and she already knew about the project and had read it and had some interest in it. So she and I met, and pretty quickly on, we were like, this could be really good. We really liked each other. She had seen Diary. She really liked it. We just kind of had an easy rapport. We both saw Lee in a very similar light and had no desire to soften her edges. You know, neither she nor I were worried about Lee not being likable. When that conversation would come up, she and I would be like, I love her. I love Lee. She's hilarious. She's amazing. She's the smartest person in every room. Why are we even worrying about this?
This is the struggle that I've had with the conversation around this movie, but just in general, the sort of notion of unlikable female protagonists. I'm like, I don't know. They seem awesome. I would like to
That's get how a drink. I felt about Lee.
I would like to get a drink with her whenever that's on offer. And so I just don't, I just still don't get it. Like, she seems really cool.
I think it's just, I mean, inherently
moderately
wrong.
Moderately unethical.
No,
but,
but I think it's an inherently wrong idea that we somehow want our female characters to be the type of person who we would wish was our mother or something. Nobody wants to see that. That's so boring. I mean, nobody asks if Tony Soprano is a likable character. Nobody asks. It's just the most interesting characters to see on screen are inherently flawed, trying to be better, failing. They're relatable. And Lee was all of those things. And I particularly related to her as a writer, as somebody who's, look, it's every artist's biggest fear is that you're going to wake up one day and no one's going to give a shit about the art you make. And you're not going to be able to make a living. And you're going to be like, now what? That's what we're all afraid of. And she was living that, you know?
All right, where do you think that fear comes from as an artist? We're going to dive deep. And do you think that, but it is, I think you're right though, right? It's like, it is a recurring theme in the conversations that I've had, both on this podcast, but just with friends and sort of socially in the industry.
Yeah.
No matter what heights you reach, there is the fear that you're going to wake up tomorrow and, you know, you're going to sort of ring the bell. There's going to be no echo and no one cares.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for most of us, I'm sure it's not true for everybody, but most of us struggled for years and years and years trying to make art, trying to find a way to be part of a bigger conversation. I waited tables for 13 years while I was acting and writing and trying to kind of make my way. It feels sort of, as you're on that path, you sort of feel like it's a goal that you will never reach. And if you do, it's slippery and it can leave you at any moment. It's such a privileged position to be in to feel like, oh, I'm going to be able to make art for the rest of my life. I think very few people feel that way. I don't know. It's just the nature. Maybe it's living in a society that doesn't really value art that much. We don't have a government which subsidizes art in any of the ways that so many countries do. I got to spend 3 months in Berlin this year, and it really opened my eyes to the ways that artists can live in other countries and can feel this sense of security and this sense of value that we don't have in our country. We just, particularly if you're a theater artist or a visual artist, I mean, I think you don't ever feel like what you are contributing is valued. You feel like you're just lucky to be there.
Right.
I don't know, but it's the freelance lifestyle. It's the, you're always looking to the next job. I don't know if it ever goes away. Does it ever go away?
I don't think it goes away. I know very, very few people who claim that it's gone away for them and that I believe them. I've definitely known some people who are like, no, I finally feel like I'm secure. And these are the same people who I know will wake up tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. and start working for fear that it's about to evaporate.
I mean, there was an interview that Oprah did with J.K. Rowling where she said, do you finally believe that the money's not going to go away? And J.K. Rowling was like, no. Do you? And Oprah was like, yeah, yeah, now I do. But even though they were talking about money, I think they were talking about the same thing, you know?
I think you're right. The irony is that they're both self-made billion, like actual self-made billionaires. And I love that Oprah's like, yeah, I mean, I walk around my unicorn farm and I feel like it's going to be okay.
But I wonder when it clicked.
I think it happened like 6 months ago.
Yeah, I don't
like,
think.
She just figured out it's going to be fine.
I think it takes a really long time. And I think, I don't know if it's that romantic idea of artists that I think the struggle is part of it. And I think losing the struggle is a bad thing. I think it's probably good for art that we all are worried we're going to lose it at any moment. I don't know.
Totally shifting gears. When was the first time you saw yourself on screen? Well, and you, since you were an actor, that's a weird question to ask. I'm not asking when you saw yourself, Mari Heller, on screen. I'm saying, when did you first see a character you were like, oh, that's me.
Mm.
Like, that's definitely me.
Well, part of what I realized when I was making Diary was that I related to male protagonists my whole life. You know, I can think about like Stand By Me and kind of all those boys, but River Phoenix particularly. Like, I remember just feeling like, not that I felt like I was like him, but I related and felt connected in this way to these young characters on screen. I mean, the biggest one for me, I'm just a cliche of a 40-year-old woman, is My So-Called Life. For me, My So-Called Life was the seminal show, made me feel seen.
I have a theory that literally every woman within a 5-year gap of my age will give the exact same answer.
I know.
I don't think there's any shame in it, honestly. That thing hit. I remember when that show came out and it was all anyone talked about.
It blew my mind.
Yeah, it was like the first primetime network show that took teenage girls seriously.
It wasn't network. Oh. It was MTV though, right?
I think it was ABC. Am I making that up?
I think it was MTV.
Okay, we'll fact check.
I'll double check it. I'm going to leave you guys to have the conversation but it is also remarkable that both Claire Danes and Jared Leto were still
I know. Everything about that show felt like it wasn't making fun of teenagers, which is my biggest pet peeve. I remember being a teenager and feeling like everything was making fun of me or talking down to me or something. But it was actually from my perspective, from a young teenage girl perspective. Everything about it just felt so respectful of the experience, respectful of the emotions, respectful of the feelings that you had when you were 15. I know.
We have an answer. It was ABC.
Oh, you were right. I'm so sorry.
It was network.
That makes no sense to me. That makes no sense.
We did MTV reruns, though. So, like, that's definitely where I feel like I watched a bunch of them was in the reruns on MTV. But, yeah, there was just, like, you know, it's nice to see the inner life of a teenage girl taken seriously. What a concept.
And it also went more surreal than I think we even remember thinking back on it. Like, there were those weird Halloween episodes and ghosts, and it was taking risks.
I do not remember ghosts in a Halloween episode.
I think I
remember the Halloween episode, but I do not remember ghosts.
It was when Ricky was homeless, and Claire Danes' character, Angela, found out he was homeless, I believe, and I might butcher this because it's been a while, and she basically went and found him living in this, like, squatter house, and then some, like, ghost of some young gay boy or something who had killed himself came back to them, and they all saw him. There was something like that. There was some storyline that was, like, totally surreal.
That weirdly does sound familiar.
Yeah.
Here's another fascinating fact about My So-Called Life. The then president of ABC, Bob Iger.
Wow.
What a time. What a time. You know, we're kind of hinting at this idea of male art and the idea of the Western canon and how that's often defined by male protagonists and male filmmakers. Are there any films in this sort of, you know, vaunted canon that you're just like, nope, not going to watch that, not going to engage?
Modern day, you mean? Or like what I was growing up with?
Yeah, I mean, we can go way back. You know, it can be like, I've never seen a Fellini movie still. Like anything from the sort of, these are the movies you're supposed to have seen.
There are so many movies that I'm supposed to have seen that I haven't seen. I feel like my film knowledge is sort of pathetic because I was a theater nerd. Like I was much more of a theater nerd than a film nerd. So honestly, when I was at the Sundance Labs, I felt like everybody was sort of making fun of me because I was constantly talking about all the things I didn't know. I was like obsessed with the things I didn't know. And a lot of that is film knowledge. I have seen a Fellini movie, but probably only one.
I actually think that's an interesting sort of extension. Is there anything in the sort of theater world that you were just like, this is a no-go for me, like this playwright, no thank you?
I mean, I kind of got there with Mamet and a lot of those sort of really masculine male playwrights that were sort of, I don't know, it just became an echo chamber of male voices at a certain point. Yeah. There's a lot of artists that I just kind of don't have an interest in their work. I stopped watching Woody Allen a long time ago. I remember when I stopped watching Woody Allen and everybody being like, come on, separate the artist from the art, which now is not the way people look at it. But 10 years ago, that's how people looked at it.
Yeah, it was not a popular opinion 15 years ago.
No.
Absolutely.
No.
Kind of the flip of that. Is there anything you put off watching for a long time? And then when you saw it, you were like, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me.
That's a good question. Wait, there is something. I'm getting a flit of a thought in my head. What is it? Truthfully, and I feel embarrassed because now I've become friends with Barry, but I waited to see Moonlight. I was nervous Moonlight was going to feel tough. I don't know. I was worried it was going to be a rough watch. Like, I knew it was going to be great. And then when I watched it, I was like, no, this is revelatory. This feels like cleansing my soul in a beautiful way. And I shouldn't have been afraid to watch it.
I know the fear you're talking about, though, because I shared it. And the only reason I saw it, I mean, Barry and I have known each other for years, and sort of I had to see it at Toronto. Like, I didn't really have a choice. Like, if I had skipped it, like, I would have felt awkward about having skipped it. But I had that fear. I remember sitting down in the theater and being like, well, this is going to be 2 hours hard fought. And I remember walking out of the theater afterwards, and it had just started raining in Toronto. And my friend who was with me was like, that was really good, right? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, do you think I could, like, win Best Picture? And I was like, only if there's any justice in the world, and I'm pretty sure there's not. Which is really hilarious in retrospect. But I definitely remember, it is. It is revelatory. It is sort of cathartic in a way that you're not expecting it to be at all, just based on the way movies that are presented like that in the industry.
I think it was the marketing. It must have been the marketing that made me feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I was being told it was an important film, which when you're being told something's an important film, it feels like it's homework a little bit. And you're like, I don't want to do something important. And instead, it should have been marketed. And I can't remember what the marketing of it was, but it should have been marketed as a religious experience. I mean, as something that was going to just like touch your soul in such a beautiful way.
It's interesting. I actually think that A24 figured that out over time, because I feel like the marketing in that early on was very much, this is an important movie that you should see. If you're not watching the black queer movie that's really good, there's something like you're failing the community. But by the end, I remember there were these two billboards on Sunset, one of which was the image of the kid on the beach. And then I can't remember what the other one was, but it definitely felt like they had pivoted to, this is extraordinary cathartic art. You want to see this because it's going to make you feel something. And
I can remember
the
image of
it.
The three faces sort of ripped, like three pieces of paper ripped together.
That was such a good poster. Yeah. I also remember then they did like the Calvin Klein campaign with Cervantes in his underwear. And I was like, oh, you guys are just selling what you have right now.
Okay, Look, okay, indie fine, movies, you got to do what you got to do.
Hey, you got to do what you got to do. If you
got
to put Cervantes and Calvin Klein's like a really good black and white. People, I remember just one morning waking up and my entire social media timeline was just filled with people talking about it. And I was like, well done, A24. Give the people what they want.
You do what you have to do to get eyeballs on little movies, you know?
Here's a fun flip on the great movie thing. What's a terrible movie that you will defend forever? Well, a lot of people talk about these as guilty pleasures, but it's just like, fuck guilty pleasure. There's no guilt in it. These are the things you love, and everyone mocks you for it, but you're right.
I don't have a movie exactly like that. I mean, the terrible movie that I love is the terrible movie that everybody loves, which is The Room, which is the reason it's so good is because it's so terrible. But I feel like we were early adopters of The Room. My sister was a college student at the time. I think she introduced my whole family to The Room early on, and we started going to screenings. And with my parents, like watching that movie every year at Christmas became like a family tradition. And
amazing.
My brother made like silkscreen t-shirts. We all went and saw Tommy Wiseau speak. Like, I became way too into The Room really, really early on. So that was one that I felt like eventually really, really caught on. But in the early days, we were in San Francisco, like into it.
Yeah, I feel like if it's a family tradition on Christmas, you can claim that one in a way that other people can't.
Yeah, I hope my parents don't listen to this. But yeah, like as a family, we would all smoke weed and watch The Room.
I just have a really nice vision of like gathered around the Yuletide, like quoting "You're tearing me apart, Lisa," like as a family in a Christmas sweater.
We're like a liberal Berkeley family who like would, yeah, who with our parents would all smoke weed, watch The Room. It was like our little family tradition that we wouldn't let like our grandma know that we were all doing. But yeah.
Speaking of the warm and fuzzies, I want to talk a bit about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, a wonderful film that Mari directed last year. In A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, you tackle one of our most beloved icons, Fred Rogers, and you manage to humanize him even in a way that no documentary or sort of book or special until this point really had. But was there fear about doing right by Mr. Rogers, or quite frankly, Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers? And how did you sort of deal with that?
Yeah, weirdly, I did not set out to make three movies about real people, but I ended up doing that. And so in a funny way, I felt like I had this comprehensive understanding about how to make movies about real people, that it required a love for the character, a sort of adoration and respect that at some point you put aside in order to dig deeper and to try to excavate their humanness in a way that could make it not a Hallmark movie. And because I had done that with Lee, and I had done that with the character of Minnie, who was really based on Phoebe, and these were characters who I loved and had this respect for, but there was also this separation because they weren't famous in that way. I felt like I understood at least the creative process I was going to go through in order to understand this person, and that you sort of have to cross over into the other side where you see them as a full human. Otherwise, you can't, I think, tell a compelling story about them, which it takes a while. I think there is this sort of process of, with Mr. Rogers, there's obviously such adoration and respect, and he's beloved. And so recognizing that everybody in the world has their own version of him, and we were never going to be able to pay homage to everybody's version of him, was something we had to come to terms with early on. But then also getting to know him in a more complete way meant spending a bunch of time in Pittsburgh, getting to know his wife, getting to know the people who were closest to him, who worked on the show with him, Bill Eisler, who was his right-hand man for 30 years. Just spending time going to dinner and hanging out with these people and hearing their stories, past the stories that they tell to journalists, and, kind of getting past that first layer of the sort of most surface level version of what you hear about people, getting deeper, till you feel like you can kind of feel that person in a more complete way. I don't know, that felt like that was the process of getting to understand him. And it doesn't mean that I ever lost adoration or respect for him, because weirdly, the deeper we went in our exploration of Fred, I think the more respect we all gained for him, because it's really easy to think of the character of Mr. Rogers as this sort of surface level, naive, good, happy person, when it was just the opposite of his mission. His mission in life was to allow children to experience and speak about the most difficult things in life, and that we shouldn't be afraid of tough emotion, and that we shouldn't be afraid of going deep and being honest about how we're feeling. And honesty was his major tenet, really, much more than happiness or anything. Or, he's known for his kindness, which he had, but he was much more interested in honesty, actually, than any of that. And that was something that I just could respect so much. And the further we went into our exploration of him, the more I felt like, wow, he's surprising in ways that I just didn't know.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Was the experience different, though, because he was a celebrity? Like you said, you've sort of done three real people, two of whom are not well-known, and then the third is Fred Rogers as played by Tom Hanks. It's sort of a cynical Hollywood question, but it's still Fred Rogers as played by Tom. Like, I remember when that announcement was made and just being like, oh, wow. Is it different? Like, the process, like you said, is very much the same intellectually, but at some point, intellectually, you look around and say, oh, that's Tom Hanks
but
playing
I think
Fred
my
Rogers.
Job as the person telling this story was to just not get swept away in any of that, to not get swept away in the Fred Rogers of it, to not get swept away in the Tom Hanks of it. In so many ways, my job was to keep us grounded and not floating away with that. Like, I sort of wished I remember when we made that announcement of our casting of him and the way it caught fire. I sort of thought, God, I wish I had just not looked at the internet for 2 weeks, because that pressure is just not helpful to the creative process, or people being excited about it at all, or not excited about it, or thinking that somehow the casting was perfect or not perfect. Or I just was like, oh, I wish I wasn't even thinking about this, because I wasn't thinking about it when I cast him. I was really thinking that I thought he was going to be perfect for the part, but not that it was Tom Hanks playing Fred Rogers. I don't know.
Right. Well, I think part of it was that everyone could agree, like, yeah, perfect for the part. Like, give it up.
But it was also what I felt the whole time we kind of had to play against, because Tom is actually so different from Fred. I don't know if you've ever gotten to hang out with Tom Hanks, but
No, I have not. I mean, I hope
he's the best
someday.
He is the best.
He seems great.
But he's so much, it's a weird thing to say, but he's really loud. He's really funny. He's really loud. Like, he has a really loud voice. He kind of walks into a room and makes jokes and shakes people's hands. He's your classic extrovert, whereas Fred was this classic introvert. And if anything, Fred, I think, was almost debilitatingly shy and pushed through his shyness by doing puppetry. That was his way of kind of getting through his inherent desire to not engage in that way, I think. I think he really is inherently very shy. So Tom was so different energetically. So as much as I understood why everybody felt like he was so perfect for the part, and we feel about him in a very similar way to the way we feel about Mr. Rogers, it also was like, is he going to be able to pull this off? Because he actually has to be really different in this part. He can't be himself. He can't just come in, put on a sweater, and kind of like cruise.
I'm glad you mentioned the point about the puppetry, because for me, watching the movie, that was one of the most striking scenes. There's that incredible shot where we have the sort of split view of Mr. Rogers doing Daniel Tiger, and you get to see the sort of forward face and the behind the scenes, which I feel like is a great metaphor for sort of, you know, being an actor who has transitioned into directing as well. The ability to sort of see the front of the frame and also see the back of the frame simultaneously. How do you manage those hats on set? I mean, look, three movies in, I think it's pretty safe to say you have a really rare talent with actors and getting performances out of actors that are incredibly remarkable. How do you sort of manage the actor and director hat on set in getting those performances?
I mean, clearly I don't act in anything that I do, because it's directing is far too big of a job and way too scary and way too hard. And I would just never try to do both things at once. I acted again recently in something, which I'm excited for it to come out. And I had such a ball acting again, but I could only do it because I trusted the director so inherently. But I do think my secret weapon as a director is that I was an actor. And so I'm not afraid of actors. And it was something I discovered when I was at the Sundance Labs, talking to all of these other directors who were there, who we were all working on our first films. And I went through the Sundance Labs with just some incredible people, and we're all really still very close today. People like David Lowery, Ryan Coogler, Chloe Zhao, Jody Lee Lipes. Like, we were a really tight,
Jesus
Jonas
Christ,
Carpignano.
That's a solid group.
No, it was a crazy year at the Sundance Labs. now in retrospect, but pretty much everybody, almost everybody had gone to film school except for me, and I had gone to theater school. I felt like they all understood so much about the technical side of filmmaking that I felt really insecure about. And then I realized that the thing that many of them felt insecure about was working with actors. And I was like, oh, that's the thing I feel fine about. I'm confident about how to talk to actors because I'm an actor. I know how to talk to actors. This is no prop. That's always been the thing that I've felt the most comfortable with. And you realize the way our film school system is set up in the US, and I don't know how it is in other countries, but we don't spend very much time learning how to work with actors. That's just not as much part of the curriculum. It's a much more technical school way of thinking, I think, most schools are, from what I understand. Like I said, never went, so I might be speaking out of my ass. But from talking to my friends, it seems like there's not as much emphasis on working with actors. So that's always been the thing that I feel like is my secret weapon, is like, oh, I'm not actually afraid of actors. And a lot of directors are.
Your film school read is dead on, by the way, at least for my film school experience. We had a whole department of theater kids, and we just like never engaged with the actors from the theater department. What a waste of time.
What a waste of time. I know. Yeah. Because it's such a big part of our job. I mean, maybe not every filmmaker views it as such a big part of their job, but for me, I mean, it's my favorite part, is getting into the weeds with the actors and figuring out the scenes and figuring out how to build a performance from the ground up with them.
It's really interesting. I worked for Sidney Pollack for the last year of his life, and he was, you know, he started as an actor and then sort of became an acting teacher, and then through that became a director, but to his last day considered himself an actor first, who got sort of dragged into directing, which is hilarious when you think about the fact that, like, he's directed, like, the sort of touchstone films in multiple genres across his 35-year career. But I remember him telling me once that he was only interested in making movies about two subjects because they were the only two things that we were no closer to understanding as human beings than we were 3,000 years ago, and that was love and war, which sort of begets this next question, which is, what is your favorite movie about love, and what is your favorite movie about war?
That is a good question. War is a harder one for me because it's just not my genre. It's not the genre I necessarily love.
What about love? Favorite movie about love? It's interesting because we've asked this question a lot to people. Not only is it the hard thing to make things about because we don't know much about them, but people have very strong feelings about the movies in these two categories. And it's really hard to come to one in each. I don't know. It's probably the question that I've been most surprised by the responses to.
What is yours?
Favorite movie about love, it's sort of a moving target. Like, some days it's In the Mood for Love. Some days it's When Harry Met Sally. There's an argument for Moonlight on days. So yeah, it varies. But again, there's no sort of right answer. And like every like favorite question, it depends on the day, depends on the moment, depends on the mood.
I know. For some reason, the movie, like, from this past year that snuck into my head was Booksmart, because I felt like it was a movie about friendship love, but it felt like a movie about love.
That's a great answer. I actually really like that.
It just felt the most genuine. It's a great love story between these two friends that's so touching, and it feels, I don't know, the most real. So many stories about love recently don't feel that real to me.
I would agree.
Call Me By Your Name got me too on being about love. War, though. What's your favorite movie about war?
Again, varies widely. You can get me with Battle of Algiers sometimes. I've been thinking a lot about Dunkirk lately.
I've never watched it. Like, I can't believe I've never watched it.
Favorite movie about war, but it is, I think that movie deserved more
credit.
Didn't
it get a lot of credit?
It got a lot of credit, but I actually think it may have deserved more. Like, I think it may have gotten dismissed as a war movie. I don't know. I think it accomplished a lot more than that. Like, it got sort of dismissed as this like big budget studio, Chris Nolan's making a war movie thing. There's some really good moments in that film.
The only movie that's coming into my head is Three Kings.
Ooh, that's a good one. I haven't thought about that movie in a while.
I haven't either until we started talking about this. And then I was like, I remember loving that movie.
That's a great call. I may need to rewatch that this week, actually. That's a really good call.
It feels so like, I don't know. I feel like there's this sort of Hollywood war movie, and then there are war movies like Three Kings, where you're like, oh, but this is what the actual war is about, or like MASH or something like that. Yeah.
MASH was great.
And it's like, you know, sometimes you want Saving Private Ryan, but sometimes you want MASH. Like,
is it okay if we ask you a question about creative collaboration with the person you love most in your life? All right. I don't know. It's always weird.
Yeah,
you never
sure.
know.
I'm not worried about it. We've been together 20 years. We're good.
All right.
Cheers to that, man. That's Kate, awesome.
Kate, yeah, cheers to that indeed. Kate, take it away.
You've collaborated with your partner in life, Yorma Daccone, and you've performed in two of the best comedies of the last decade, at least for my money, MacGruber and Popstar Never Stop Stopping.
I haven't quite performed. Let's say I've made very brief cameos, like one line in each, just for fun.
Popstar, there needs to be justice for Popstar.
I agree. Justice for Popstar. Let's get that going as a hashtag. I agree. Popstar was such a, it was such a sad casualty of like film trends or something.
I think what's going to happen to Popstar, what happened to Walk Hard, is that like in 10 years, people are going to be like, oh, this is way funnier than anybody thought at the time.
Which is what happened to MacGruber. MacGruber was the type of movie that got so dismissed when it first came out. I think it got pulled from the theaters after 1 or 2 weeks. It gained cult status so quickly because people realized how hilarious it was. Popstar, I feel like, suffered purely because it was a mockumentary. And it was like at the moment the world decided like, I think we're done with mockumentaries. And it was just so unfortunate because it was so hilarious. And I feel like people just kind of missed it.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through the track list, which is my temptation, but I will say if you haven't listened to Fuck Bin Laden, I highly recommend it.
I agree.
Popstar, the cult is going to come back around.
It should.
But, you know, in a marriage where both parties are insanely talented, how do you guys help feed each other's creativity without feeling like you're pushing your own artistic voice on the other person?
Well, we can't really push our own artistic voice on each other because we're so different in what we like. It's sort of hilarious because Yorm has been doing this a lot longer than I have. I mean, I was an actor. This whole time we met in theater school, we met at UCLA when we were really young. And he was making comedy shorts even back then with Akiva and Andy. So they've been doing this the whole time that I've known them. And also he, not only did he know how to act, but he knew how to direct and he knew how to edit. And he was also making the music for all of their shorts and everything really early on. So they learned everything that they learned how to do together and they developed their own style. And it's like they speak their own language and it's a comedy language and their style of editing is a comedy style of editing and their style, you know, everything they do has its own style. And everything I do is so different. I mean, Yorma comes and sits in the edit room with me and he goes crazy because I cut so slowly and I leave shots for so long. And he's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Cut, 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 cut. Like he can't stand it. And I'm like, no, I love the way her eyebrow just lifts this tiny bit there. I just want to stay till that. And he's like, what? You know, it's like, it's just, we operate at a different speed. He's like a hummingbird and I'm like a cat. And I totally understand what he does and he totally understands what I do. But I think it is this funny thing where like, I mean, I told him not to make Dick in a Box. I thought it was terrible. So what do I know? I mean,
that. And we have made news today.
That is
the story out of this conversation.
He explained it to me. He came to me and was like, what about a song about a guy giving his dick to his girlfriend in a box for Christmas? I was like, that sounds offensive, horrible. Don't make that. And he made it anyway. And what do I know? So clearly, like, we can't influence each other that much. I mean, it just wouldn't work. But we are incredibly supportive of each other. Yorma's incredibly supportive of, in many ways, my career took off a lot later than his. For so long, I felt like I was sort of an SNL wife where nobody knew what I did or what I was making. I was sort of just there on the sidelines. And he's couldn't be more enthusiastic about the shift that's happened in our marriage and in our relationship. When we went to make the Mr. Rogers movie in Pittsburgh, he came with me for 5 months. He was primary parent to our kid. He was so, so excited to kind of just let the roles shift, as hard as that can be. And it is hard. It's hard for couples, I think, when there's a kind of ever-shifting power balance happening. But he is also so excited about that and is my biggest cheerleader. And I feel the same about him. In some ways, I think it's great that we do different things. Like, we like different things. We have a different sense of what, you know. I mean, he constantly loves feeling like, especially because he's been famous or, you know, like cult level internet famous for a while. Yeah. And so the fact that when he like goes to Sundance parties with me and stuff, no one knows who he is. He just thinks it's hilarious. And the fact that
Well, I mean, I remember when we met, it was at like an Oscar Academy New Members event in New York, and you and I had just gotten in, and Yorma was there as your guest. And he was so excited about
it. He loves feeling like a second-class citizen in that way.
Can I get you guys, can I get you guys a drink? I remember him like being like, hey, guys, you guys are members. I'm going to go get
it's
you guys something
from
the bar.
His thinking, favorite joke is like, I will never be admitted into this club. I will never be a part of this. I make dick jokes.
Well, I just remember
you make art.
Like,
I get it. That's his favorite joke.
I just remember thinking like, that's how you're supposed to be when your partner is crushing it. As like a mental reference.
That's good. I like that. I think that's really sweet.
No. All right. Two more questions and then we'll let you escape our clutches. And they're sort of big, you know, airy, ethereal things. The first is single image from a film that has stayed with you the longest. And we will not use the images that were burned into your brain from Seven.
No. I mean, the most recent one was the ending shot of Roma. Which... I just didn't understand how they made, and it was just so affecting to me and all the ocean. I don't know. There was something about it. It just really, really stuck with me. I'm trying to think further back into like the films that helped to shape me or how, what image I can think of from early films. And nothing's flooding my mind.
I think the Roma answer is a good one. It's an indelible image. Like I remember seeing that at Toronto too and just being like, wait, how, what? And then just being.
And then
sort of
I was on
away.
A panel with him, and he was basically saying, "No, we just did it. We just actually did the thing. And if it didn't,
the thing that you think,
and
you
if,
can't
if
do,
it
yeah.
didn't work out, then it would have been a very different ending to the film." And we were all kind of like, "What?"
Oh man,
he's a little bit like that though, right? Where you're just like,
he was so sweet and funny and like. Human, it was really refreshing, actually.
But I think that's what I mean, though. And then you're just like, but look at everything you've done. How are you so normal and human?
But that's my favorite thing about filmmakers and talking to other directors. I mean, pretty much every director I've ever met, I'm like, oh, you're so normal. You're so regular. You just feel I don't know. And that's been such a joy of getting to be 2 years in a row on the campaign trail for Oscars, which is in itself torture, but part of the joy is just getting to meet other directors and getting to actually share conversations and have those kinds of moments where you go like, so the final shot of Roma, how'd you do that? And you get to actually just hear and be like, we just did it. We just actually had them go in the water. We actually did it. And we didn't know what was going to happen. And you're like, oh, that's the opposite of what I expected you to say. it's wonderful.
Kate, take us home.
So we like to end with the same question every time, which is if we could get rid of time zones and figure out a universal streaming platform and you could stream one movie for the entirety of planet Earth, what movie would you pick?
Wait, it's the only movie I can play from here on out for forever?
No, just one-time screening.
No. Got it.
One-time screening for all of humanity.
That would be torture. Just like, here's one movie you get to watch.
That's what I was going to Desert Island like. What is the only piece of art you need to sustain yourself,
time,
which right now feels too poignant.
Right. One time worldwide screening.
The movie that Yorma would say if he were here is he would say Rad, which is the BMX biking movie starring Lori Loughlin.
Great pick.
That's
Pure
that
Cinema.
Would definitely be his pick. I wish I had something as clear for myself.
Soon to be federal prisoner, Lori Loughlin.
I know. Oh my God.
Think about a life.
Aunt
what
Becky
a life trajectory.
Went so astray.
Aunt Becky, man. But before she was Aunt Becky, she was
in
Red.
I just think it's hilarious how hard she's
fighting. She's in pure denial. What, right? What the hell?
She was just. Felicity was just like, ah, fuck it. Let me just.
Felicity
do
was like,
and get
I fucked up.
With.
I fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I fucked up. I'm going to do my time. They're going to let me out free quickly because I'm a celebrity. And Lori's like, no, my baby deserved to go
it's
to UCLA.
Wild.
And then
I think it was USC, right?
Star.
It was USC.
It was USC. You're right.
I'm like,
USC. You're right.
Not that I care.
All right, let's get
I'm
let's
trying
get your,
to come
let's
up
get
with
answer.
One. I'm terrible at these.
I think you should just say Rad, honestly.
Okay, and right, in homage to my husband, because this would be the movie he would pick, and I think his comedic sensibility is better for this moment in time. I'm going to say Rad, the BMX movie. It's basically Karate Kid with BMX biking that Lori Loughlin is in.
Yeah.
Because We showed that on his 40th birthday. It's the movie, it's the go-to movie that he always wants to share with the world. And I do think it would make us feel pretty good right now.
You heard it here, folks. Everybody in the world should watch Rad, starring Lori Loughlin.
I believe it's Rad exclamation point is the full title, too, right? Yeah, which cannot be forgotten. Any movie with an exclamation point in the title is, you know, worth seeing.
Definitely.
Thanks so much, Mari.
Thank you, guys.
From Luminary, the Blacklist podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are me, Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Sani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Patel composed our theme music, and this episode was edited and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter at Franklin Leonard, at Franklin J. Leonard on Instagram. Kate is That Hagen Girl, girl, G-R-R-L, on both. And we, The Blacklist, are The, T-H-E-B-L-C-K-L-S-T.